Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. What we have been doing for some months now is exploring the myths about money. Our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest, to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. We've been specifically looking at a book called The Web of Debt, which unravels the deception and presents a clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading. It then explores workable alternatives, particularly one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. It helps us to analyze and improve our own financial security, personally and nationally, and to deeply understand the cause of the problems we are personally experiencing financially. At the onset, I give an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles on debt-related matters. I highly recommend her book, The Web of Debt. You should also visit her website by the same name. You could also go to www.kruufm.com under Archives to listen to all of the shows produced on this and other debt-related topics. This particular series is under Life and Debt Web. At the end of the last show, we discussed the concept of extinguishing the national debt with the click of a mouse. In the 1980s, a chairman of the Coinage Subcommittee of the U.S. House of Representatives pointed out that the national debt could be paid with a single coin. The Constitution gives Congress the power to coin money and regulate its value, and no limitation is put on the value of the coins it creates. In other words, the entire national debt could be extinguished with a single coin minted by the U.S. Mint, stamped with the appropriate face value. In 2007, this official might have suggested 9 coins, each with the face value of $1 trillion, while today that would probably be 15 coins, going on 16, each worth $1 trillion. One problem with that clever solution is, how do you make change for a $1 trillion coin? The value of this mega coin would obviously come not from its metal content, but simply from the numerical value stamped on it. If the government can stamp a piece of metal and call it $1 trillion, it should be able to create paper money or digital money and call it the same thing. As Andrew Jackson observed, when the Founding Fathers gave Congress the power to coin money, they did not mean to limit Congress to metal money and let the banks create the rest. They meant to give the power to create the entire national money supply to Congress. Jefferson said that constitutions needed to be amended to suit the times. And today, the coin of the times is paper money, checkbook money, and electronic money. The constitutional provision that gives Congress the power to coin money needs to be updated to read the power to create the national money supply in all its forms. If that modification were made, most of the government's debt could be paid online. The simplicity of the procedure was demonstrated by the U.S. Treasury itself in January of 2004 when it called or redeemed a 30-year bond issue before the bond was due. The Treasury announced in January of 2004, quote, "The Treasury today announced the call for redemption at par on May 15, 2004 of the 9 1/8% Treasury bonds of 2004 to 2009, originally issued May 1979, due May 2009. There are 4,606 million of these bonds outstanding, of which 3,109 million are held by private investors. Securities not redeemed on May 15, 2004 will stop earning interest. These bonds are being called to reduce the cost of debt financing. The 9 1/8% interest rate is significantly above the current cost of securing financing for the 5 years remaining to their maturity. In current market conditions, the Treasury estimates that interest savings from the call and refinancing will be about $544 million. Payment will be made automatically by the Treasury for bonds in book entry form, whether held on the books of the Federal Reserve or in the Treasury direct accounts," end quote. The provision for payment in book entry form meant that no dollar bills, checks, or other paper currencies would be exchanged. Numbers would just be directed into the Treasury's direct online money market fund, Treasury Direct. The securities would merely change character from interest-bearing to non-interest-bearing, from a debt owed to a debt paid. The bondholders failing to redeem their securities by May 15, 2004, could still collect the face amount of the bonds in cash. They just would not receive interest on the bonds. The Treasury's announcement generated some controversy, since government bonds are usually considered good until maturity, but early redemption was actually allowed in the fine print of the bonds. Provisions for early redemption are routinely written into corporate and municipal bonds so that when interest rates drop, the issuer can refinance the debt at a lower rate. Well, how did the Treasury plan to refinance this $4 billion bond issue at a lower rate? Any bonds not bought by the public would no doubt be bought by the banks. Recall the testimony of the Federal Reserve Board Chairman Mariner Eccles, quote, "When the banks buy $1 billion of government bonds as they are offered, they actually create, by a bookkeeping entry, $1 billion, close quote. If the Treasury can cancel its promise to pay interest on a bond issue simply by announcing its intention to do so, and if it can refinance the principal with bookkeeping entries, it can pay off the entire federal debt that way. It just has to announce that it is calling its bonds and other securities and that they will be paid in book entry form. No cash needs to change hands. The funds can remain in the accounts where the bonds were held to be reinvested somewhere else. Indeed, at this point, the only way to pay off the debt is for the government to issue fiat money, buy back its bonds, and void them out." That is the conclusion of Goldbug leader Ed Griffin in The Creature from Jekyll Island, as well as of the Greenbacker leader, Stephen Zerlenga, in model legislation called the American Monetary Act. Zerlenga notes that the federal debt needn't be paid off all at once. The government's debts extend several decades into the future and could be paid gradually as the securities came due. We'll expand upon this later. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now let's move ahead to liquidating the federal debt without causing inflation, which is the big problem. According to Alexander Hamilton's report on the public credit in January of 1790, the national debt answers most of the purpose of money. End quote. The idea that the federal debt could be liquidated by simply printing up money and buying back the government's bonds with it is dismissed out of hand by economists and politicians on the ground that it would produce Weimar-style runaway inflation. But would it? Inflation results when the money supply increases faster than goods and services, and replacing government securities with cash would not change the size of the money supply. Federal securities have been traded as part of the money supply ever since Alexander Hamilton made them the basis of the U.S. money supply in the late 18th century. Federal securities are treated by the Fed and by the market itself just as if they were money. For banks and brokerages, they are legal collateral. They are traded daily in enormous volume among banks and other financial institutions around the world, just as if they were money. If the government were to buy back its own securities with cash, these instruments representing financial value would merely be converted from interest-bearing into non-interest-bearing financial assets. The funds would move from M2 and M3 into M1, which is cash and checks, but the total money supply would remain the same. That would be true if the government were to buy back its securities with cash, but that is very different from what is happening today. When the Federal Reserve uses newly issued Federal Reserve notes to buy back federal bonds, it does not void out the bonds. Rather, they become the reserves for issuing many times their value in new loans. And new cash created to buy these securities is added to the money supply as well. That highly inflationary result could be avoided if the government were to buy back its own bonds and rip them up or void them out, taking them out of circulation. In today's illusory financial scheme, debt is money. Money has been variously defined as a medium that can be exchanged for goods and services, and assets and property considered in terms of monetary value, wealth. What falls under those definitions, however, keeps changing. In November of 2005, an article titled M3 Measure of Money Discontinued by the Fed, Bud Conrad observed, quote, "Money used to mean the cash people carried in their pockets and the checking and savings account balances they had in their banks, because that is what they would use to buy goods. But now they have money market funds, which function almost as checking accounts. And behind any small balance checking accounts are large lines of credit. Credit is what we use to buy things, so credit is a form of money. The broadest definition of credit is all debt." End quote. All debt includes the federal debt, which is composed of securities, bills, bonds, and notes. If the government were to swap its securities for cash and take them out of circulation, price inflation would not result because no one would have any more money to spend than before. The government's bond money would already have been spent, so it wouldn't get any more money out of the deal, and the cashed-out bondholders would not be any richer either. Consider a hypothetical. You have $20,000 that you want to save for a rainy day. You deposit the money in account with your broker, who recommends putting $10,000 into the stock market and $10,000 into corporate bonds, and you agree. How much do you think you have saved in the account? $20,000. A short time later, your broker notifies you that your bonds have been unexpectedly called or turned into cash. You check your account on the internet and see that where before it contained $10,000 in corporate bonds, it now contains $10,000 in cash. How much do you now think you have saved in the account? $20,000, plus or minus some growth in interest and fluctuations in the stock values, of course. Paying off the bonds did not give you an additional $10,000, making you feel richer than before, prompting you to rush out to buy shoes or real estate you did not think you could afford before, increasing demand and driving up prices. This result is particularly obvious when we look at the largest holders of federal securities, including Social Security and other institutional investors. So let's think about this. How about solving the Social Security crisis? In March 2005, the federal debt clocked in at $7.713 trillion. That sum, $3.169 trillion, or 41%, was in intragovernmental holdings, government trust funds, revolving funds, and special funds. Chief among them was the Social Security Trust Fund, which held $1.705 trillion of the government's debt. The 59% owned by the public was also held largely by institutional investors, U.S. and foreign banks, investment funds, and so forth. Dire warnings followed that Social Security was going bankrupt since its holdings were invested in federal securities that the government could not afford to redeem. Defenders of the system countered that Social Security could not actually go bankrupt because it is a pay-as-you-go system. Today's retirees are paid with withdrawals from the paychecks of today's working people. It is only the fund's excess holdings that are at risk, and it is the government, not Social Security, that is teetering on bankruptcy because it is the government that lacks the money to pay off its bonds. The issue here, though, is what would happen if the Social Security crisis were resolved by simply cashing out its federal bond holdings with newly issued U.S. notes? Would dangerous inflation result? The likely answer is that it would not, because the Social Security Fund would have no more money than it had before. The government would just be returning to the fund what the taxpayers thought was in it all along. The bonds would be turned into cash, which would stay in the fund where it belonged, to be used for future baby boomer payouts as intended. So that solves the Social Security problem. What about cashing out the federal securities of the Federal Reserve? Another institution holding a major chunk of the federal debt is the Federal Reserve itself. At the end of 2004, the Fed owned about 10% of the government's outstanding securities. If the government were to buy back these securities with cash, that money too, no doubt, would stay where it is, where it would continue to serve as the reserves against which loans were made. The cash would just replace the bonds, which would be liquidated and taken out of circulation. Again, consumer prices would not go up because there would be no more money in the circulation than there was before. That is one way to deal with the Federal Reserve Treasury securities, but an even neater solution has been proposed. The government could just void out the bonds. Recall that the Federal Reserve acquired its governmental securities without consideration, and that a contract without consideration is void. What would the Federal Reserve use in that case for reserves? Article 30 of the Federal Reserve Act of 1913 gave Congress the right to rescind or alter the act at any time. If the act were modified to make the Federal Reserve a truly federal agency, it would not need to keep reserves. It could issue the full faith and credit of the United States directly without having to back its dollars with government bonds. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now let's look at cashing out the holdings of foreign central banks. Other major institutional holders of U.S. government bonds are foreign central banks. At the end of 2004, foreign holdings of U.S. Treasury debt came to about $1.9 trillion, roughly comparable to the $1.7 trillion held in the Social Security Trust Fund. Of that sum, foreign central banks owned 64% or $1.2 trillion. What would cashing out those securities do to the money supply? Again, probably not much. Foreign central banks have no use for consumer goods, and they do not invest in real estate. They keep U.S. dollars in reserve to support their own currencies in global markets and to have the dollars available to buy oil as required under a 1974 agreement with OPEC. They keep dollars in reserve either as cash or as U.S. securities. Holding U.S. securities is considered to be the equivalent of holding dollars that pay interest. If these securities were turned into cash, the banks would probably just keep the cash in reserve in place of the bonds and count themselves lucky to have the dollars back on what is turning out to be a rather risky investment. Fears have been voiced that the U.S. government may soon be unable to pay even the interest on the federal debt. When that happens, the U.S. can either declare bankruptcy and walk away, or it can buy back the bonds with newly issued fiat money. Given the choice, the foreign investors would probably be happy to accept the fiat money, which they could spend on real goods and services in the economy. And if they complained, the U.S. government could argue that turnabout is fair play. John Succo is a hedge fund manager who writes on the internet as Mr. Practical. He estimates that as much as 90% of the foreign money used to buy U.S. securities comes from foreign central banks, which print their own local currencies, buy U.S. dollars with them, and then use the dollars to buy U.S. securities. The U.S. government would just be giving them their fiat currency back. Market commentators worry that as foreign central banks cash in their U.S. securities, U.S. dollars will come flooding back into the U.S. markets, hyperinflating the money supply and driving up consumer prices. But we've seen that this predicted result has not materialized in China, although foreign money has been flooding its economy for thousands of years. American factories and industries are now laying off workers because they lack customers. A return of U.S. dollars to U.S. shores could prime the pump, giving lagging American industries the boost they need to again become competitive with the rest of the world. We are continually being urged to shop for the good of the economy. What would be so bad about having our dollars returned to us by some foreigners who wanted to do a little shopping? In the years of the housing boom, home refinancings were a major source of consumer spending dollars. As the money supply has shrunk with the housing correction, a supply of spending dollars from abroad could be just the quick fix the economy needs to reverse a deflationary crisis. There is the concern that U.S. assets could wind up in the hands of foreign owners, but there is not much we can do about that short of imposing high tariffs or making foreign ownership illegal. We sold them the bonds and we owe them the cash. In any case, that is a completely different issue from the effects of cashing out foreign-held bonds with fiat dollars, which would give foreigners no more claim to our assets than they have with their bonds. In the long run, they would have less claim to U.S. assets since their dollar investments would no longer be accruing additional dollars in interest. Foreign central banks are reducing their reserves of U.S. securities, whether we like it or not. The tide is rolling out, and U.S. bonds will be flooding back to U.S. shores. The question for the U.S. government is simply, who will take up the slack when foreign creditors quit rolling over U.S. debt? Today, when no one else wants the bonds sold at auction, the Fed and its affiliated banks step in and buy them with dollars created for the occasion, resulting in two sets of securities, the bonds and the cash, where before there was only one. This inflationary duplication could be avoided if the Treasury were to buy back the bonds itself and just void them out. Congress could then avoid the debt problem in the future by following the lead of the Guernsey Islanders and simply refusing to go into debt. Rather than issuing bonds to meet its costs, it could issue dollars directly. But what about stock market bubbles? Even if cashing out the government's bonds did not inflate consumer prices, would it not trigger dangerous inflation in the stock market, the bond market, and the real estate market, the likely targets of the freed up money? Well, let's see. In December of 2005, the market value of all publicly traded companies in the United States was reported at $15.8 trillion. Assume that fully half the $8 trillion then invested in government securities got reinvested in the stock market. If the government securities were paid off gradually as they came due, new money would enter those markets only gradually, moderating any inflationary effects. But eventually, the level of stock market investment would have increased by 25%. Is that too much? Not really. The S&P 500, a stock index tracking 500 companies in leading industries, actually tripled from 1995 to 2000, and no great disaster resulted. Much of that rise was due to the technology bubble, which later broke, but by 2006, the S&P had gained back most of its losses. High stock prices are actually good for investors who make money across the board. Stocks are not household necessities that shoot out of reach for ordinary consumers when prices go up. The stock market is the casino of people with money to invest. Anyone with any amount of money can jump in at any time, at any level. If the market continues to go up, investors will make money on resale. Although this may look like a Ponzi scheme, it really isn't so long as the stocks are bought with cash rather than debt. Like with the inflated value of prized works of art, stock prices will go up due to increased demand, and so long as the demand remains strong, the stocks would maintain their values. Stock market bubbles are bad only when they burst, and they burst because they have been artificially pumped up in a way that cannot be sustained. The market crash of 1929 resulted because investors were buying stock largely on credit, thinking the market would continue to go up and they could pay off the balance from profits. The stock market became a speculative pyramid scheme in which most of the money invested in it did not really exist. The bubble burst when reserve requirements were raised, making money much harder to borrow. In the scenario we just considered here, the market would not be pumped up with borrowed money, but would be infused with cold hard cash, the permanent money received by bondholders for their government bonds. The market would go up and stay up. At some point, investors would realize that their shares were overpriced relative to the company's assets and would find something else to invest in. But that correction would be a normal one, not the sudden collapse of a bubble built on credit with no real money in it. There would still be the problem of speculative manipulation by big banks and hedge funds, but that problem too can be addressed, and we will do that in future shows. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt-manageable life.